Richard Heinberg is the author of the new book, Power Down: Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. And he's also the author of another book called The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies. So he has a lot of other books to his credit as well. And he is also a member of the core faculty at New College of California, which I believe is in Santa Rosa. And he also has an online newsletter called Museletter, M-U-S-E-L-E-T-T-E-R. He has been writing about energy and resource issues and the dynamics of cultural change for many years. So I will turn this right over to him, Richard Heinberg.
Thank you. Well, I'm delighted that you're having this this occasion, this day, to talk about this extremely important issue. Travel is such that I was only able to get here for the film on Cuba just a few minutes ago, which I thought was wonderful. The film did not discuss the energy aspects of the situation. It described the plight of Cuba in the 1990s as being mostly due to the embargo, which it certainly partly was, but it was also partly due to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And as a result of that, the cutoff in oil imports to Cuba, and actually Soviet Union, which is a major oil exporting nation and oil producing nation, was exporting oil to Cuba so cheaply that the Cubans during the 1980s were taking that oil and re-exporting it at a profit. Cuban farmers were using more petrochemicals on their land per acre than American farmers were in the 1980s. So when the Soviet Union collapsed and that source of cheap energy suddenly ran out for the Cubans, that was the main cause of their agricultural crisis, in which, as we saw, there was general sort of malnourishment for a period of time. Nobody starved because they shared, but there was a general lack of food. And they have managed to solve their problem to a large extent by turning to organic agriculture, by moving producers and consumers closer together, by growing thousands of gardens right in the middle of Havana. And these are the kinds of strategies that we here in the U.S. are going to have to turn to increasingly as well. So I'm going to give you my short presentation here with some graphs. You already are familiar with the concept of peak oil from having seen the end of suburbia, but I'm going to go into a little bit more detail, and then hopefully we'll have some time for some discussion and questions afterward, because what I'm really interested in with this more than anything else is to help you all find ways of dealing with this in your local community. So peak oil, of course, is not the only challenge facing us in the coming days. We also have the problems of declining per capita food production in the face of continuing population growth. We hit 6 billion in 1999 globally, as a global population. And even though rate of population growth globally is tapering off, the fact is that since 1999, we've added about 400 million more people, which is about equivalent to North America's population. So we've added a North America just since 1999. And of course, we haven't added a North America's worth of resources and support infrastructure. So in sheer numbers, continuing population growth is a problem, especially given the fact that per capita food production is declining. And of course, the problems of climate change, pollution, habitat destruction, loss of biodiversity, and unsustainable levels of U.S. debt, that hardly seems like a problem in the same category as the others, except that if this does, in fact, lead to a national and possibly international financial meltdown, which is many, many financial analysts are warning of this right now, if that happens, then we won't have much spare capital to invest in solving these other problems. And solving these other problems is going to take extraordinary levels of investment. So let's turn to the first problem in the list, which is peak oil. And of course, I'm going to talk mostly about that because I think it's, well, all of these other problems are related in some way to the fact that we've gotten addicted to oil in the first place. You know, we created industrial societies over the past 200 years because we had lots of cheap energy to do it with. And so if cheap energy is about to run out, that's something to pay attention to. Oil depletion is not something that may or may not happen in the future. It's something that's been happening during our lifetimes. And the effects of peak oil are not something to speculate about. We can see them in our lives. When I was born in 1950, the U.S. was the world's foremost oil-producing nation, the world's foremost oil-exporting nation for much of the 20th century. And a lot went with that, power and wealth. Now, in 2004, a lot has changed, of course. Now, of course, we're the world's foremost oil importing nation and the world's foremost debtor nation. The rest of the world is investing something like $2.8 billion a day to keep our economy afloat. We're sucking up the rest of the world's savings, essentially. And as Alan Greenspan told us 2 weeks ago, the rest of the world is getting a bit tired of having to support our profligate standard of living. Now, is all of this, these changes that have happened since between 1950 and 2004, is all of this just the result of bad management? Of course, we've seen a lot of that, particularly in the last few years, I'd say, last 4 years. But I would say it's not all something that can be chalked up to bad management. There's something underlying that, which is the depletion of the resource base that made this the wealthiest and most powerful nation in the history of the world. This is where the oil industry started back in the 1860s. And of course, there was a very bright young man named John D. Rockefeller who figured out very early on how to make a fortune from the stuff. You know, at first, our experience with oil resulted from the depletion of another resource, which was whales. We were using whale oil to illuminate our houses, and we were killing off all of the whales very effectively. So whale oil was getting more expensive. Somebody had the bright idea that you could substitute this stuff that oozed out of the ground that people called rock oil or petroleum. The literal translation of petroleum is rock oil. You could use that instead of whale oil to light houses. And of course, it worked perfectly for that. John D. Rockefeller became the world's wealthiest man by cornering the market on the stuff here in the U.S. and almost globally. He created the world's first multinational corporation, Standard Oil. And Rockefeller money has insinuated itself into almost every aspect of this nation, from the banking industry to the university system and on and on and on. So this is really an empire of oil that we're living in. This is an interesting slide. This shows a stacked representation of work done over time in the U.S. by humans, domesticated animals, and machines as a percentage of the total horsepower in the economy. So this is all the work that gets done, right? It takes energy to do work. And in 1850, most of that work was done by the muscle power of domesticated animals, horses and oxen. And about 18% was done by human muscle power, quite a lot of that by enslaved, kidnapped Africans. And only about 17 or 18% was done by fuel-fed machinery. Now, by the 1960s, the amount of work being done by muscle power, either animal or human, is negligible. It doesn't even show up on the graph anymore. So when you hear about increases in labor productivity, what does that really mean? Does that mean people are working harder? No, not at all. Virtually 100% of increase in labor productivity comes about through people controlling the actions of fuel-fed machinery in the production process. Okay, this is where all of that new energy has come from for the U.S. economy. This is renewable energy in the U.S. economy, and this is non-renewable energy. Obviously, this is where the growth has been. The interesting thing about this slide is, as you can see, there's about as much renewable energy in the U.S. economy today as there was in 1850. Actually, there's about twice as much. But of course, the population has far more than doubled since 1850. We've become accustomed to an energy-intensive way of life, and we think of it as normal. This is normal life, right? Get in your car and drive to the store, turn up the thermostat if you're a little cool, and throw your clothes in the washer if they're dirty. But if all of those services had to be performed by human muscle power, how many humans would it take to keep us each in the standard of living to which we have become accustomed? Well, it'd take about 300. We each have about 300 energy slaves trailing around after us, picking up our dirty clothes and pushing us down the street and heating our homes and for us and so on. That's normal. And of course, oil is important for 97% of transportation energy. It's also critical for industrial agriculture, chemicals, pharmaceuticals, clothing, and all sorts of consumer products, everything you can think of that's made of plastic. So this is the U.S. experience with oil, and this is very important. This should be burned into the brain of every U.S. citizen. You know, this should be what kids in school study for about 2 weeks. Here's Discovery, the vertical red bars, and as you can see, Discovery peaked right around 1930 with discoveries in East Texas. And Discovery in the U.S. has been going downhill ever since. And this is what the industry calls production. Of course, the word production just means extraction. Nobody's actually producing oil out of something else. It's just, you know, you're just pulling it out of the ground. So this is extraction, which peaked about 40 years later in 1970, 1971, and it's been going downhill ever since, too. Well, that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? You have to discover it before you can extract it, and that's what we did. Now, this is important for U.S. history, and it's also important for understanding the history and future of the rest of the world, because the U.S. is the prototype. This is where the industry started. This is where the oil business has had its most experience. More oil wells have been drilled in the lower 48 U.S. than in the rest of the world put together. So this experience of peak in discovery, followed after a time lag by peak in production, is going to happen in every other oil-producing country. And in fact, that's exactly what has been happening. Over the last 30, 35 years, one country after another has followed suit, done exactly the same thing, as we will see. Now, this peak in oil extraction in the U.S. probably deserves to be considered the most important event in modern American history. We don't think of it that way. You know, we don't talk about it. We don't obsess over it. We don't make movies about it. We don't watch PBS miniseries about the U.S. oil production peak and the fallout from it and so on. But really, think about those two slides we saw earlier, the U.S. in 1950 and the U.S. in 2004. When did that all change? Well, not at a definable moment, you know, July 1st, 1970, it all changed. But there was a kind of an inflection point there. Because prior to that time, we were self-sufficient. And after that time, we necessarily, in order to maintain our way of life, became more and more dependent on other countries. So this had economic impacts, and it also had foreign policy or geopolitical impacts. And that was driven home 3 years later with the oil embargo of 1973, where oil prices went up 400%. And then later in 1979, with the fall of the Shah of Iran, and there's a story there, I mean, where did the Shah of Iran come from? Well, the CIA put him in place in 1953 because the Iranians had the effrontery to elect this guy named Mossadegh, who nationalized the oil industry of Iran. So, of course, we couldn't stand that. So we took him out. This U.S. has been interested in oil from a geopolitical point of view for a long time, but that interest was really peaked when it became apparent that our domestic supplies were going to inevitably decline, and we were going to be more dependent on other countries. So in 79, with the fall of the Shah of Iran, oil prices go up another 200%, and we get the Carter Doctrine, which says that henceforth the U.S. will use its military to maintain its access to the oil supplies of the Middle East. So a lot has changed. Following its national oil production peak, the U.S. was able to compensate by importing more oil from other nations. However, following the global oil production peak, we will not be able to compensate by importing more oil from other planets. You see, as important as the U.S. oil production peak was, the global oil production peak, when it happens, and it's not a question of if, everyone has agreed that it will happen. The only dispute is over when. The global oil production peak is going to be far more significant than the U.S. oil production peak was. Now, let's get to the technical part of the discussion. Okay, if it is going to happen, when is it going to happen? How soon is it going to be? How do we know? Why should we believe the pessimists who say it's going to be in the next few years? Why are the optimists who say it may not be until 2025 or 2030? Why aren't they correct? Well, let me tell you. There are basically four ways of predicting the oil production peak. The simplest, and the one that was used initially by M. King Hubbert, the petroleum geologist who started the whole science of oil depletion back in the 1940s and 50s, the easiest way is to simply calculate about how much is there that you'll be able to ultimately to extract, the ultimately recoverable amount, and then divide that by half and see when you're going to reach that halfway point of extraction. Why half? Well, Hubbert found by studying the experience of the oil companies that it was typically true that when about half of the total recoverable amount in any reservoir, any oil well, had been extracted, the peak in the bell curve of extraction tended to come. The cheap, easy stuff would be drawn out of the ground first, and what was left would take more effort and time to extract, and so there was this inevitable Hubbert curve that happened, and the peak tended to happen about halfway. There's no magic to that. There's no natural law that says it has to be halfway, because there are, of course, economic and political factors that can cause the peak to come earlier or later, but it's a first-level guesstimate of when total production is likely to peak. So let's see. In terms of this first method, where are we? How much do we have ultimately to extract? Well, there's quite a range of estimates, all the way from fewer than 1,500 billion barrels total in the world to up to 3,000 billion or 3 trillion barrels. But as you can see, over the past 30 years, the estimates have tended to cluster around 2 trillion barrels. Now, how much is 2 trillion barrels, or 2,000 billion barrels? It's about 100 cubic miles. And so far, we've extracted about half of that. So we've extracted just shy of 1 trillion barrels. So we're just about at the halfway point. So using this first method, which again only gives us a very rough guesstimate, that would suggest we're coming up upon the peak fairly soon. Another way of arriving at an idea of how much total there is to get out of the ground, the total ultimately recoverable, is using what's called a creaming curve. And basically, this is just showing how much has been discovered cumulatively in every year. So as of 1950, this is how much had been cumulatively discovered. In 75, this is how much had been cumulatively discovered. As you can see, during these years, there was a lot of discovery, so the curve is going up dramatically, but as time has gone on, the rate of discovery has decreased, so the curve is approaching this limit, what mathematicians call an asymptote, which is right around 2,100 billion barrels. Again, a little more than 2 trillion barrels. Okay, so second way to predict peak. Count the number of years from peak of discovery to peak of extraction. As you recall, in the U.S., there was about a 40-year time lag between peak of discovery and peak of extraction. Again, there's no universal law that says it has to be 40 years. In some countries, experience has shown that it's less than that, where we've used the very best modern extraction technique to get that oil out faster. And in some cases, there's been a longer than 40-year time lag where, for political or economic reasons, the oil hasn't been extracted at the maximum rate. A good example of that is Iraq, where because of the sanctions and because of the war with Iran during the 1980s, the rate of extraction has not been at the theoretical maximum. So the lag between peak of discovery and peak of extraction in Iraq is likely to be on the order of 50 or 60 years. However, all of these countries sort of average out. And so given that, a good guess, again, is that globally the peak of extraction is going to be roughly 40 years from peak of discovery. Okay, when was peak of discovery? No secret to that, about 1963. And this slide is not controversial. It comes from the most impeccable source, ExxonMobil. It's from the slide presentation of the Executive Vice President, Harry Longwell. And similar curves have been drawn by the International Energy Agency, USGS, and so on. So that, again, this is not controversial information. Now, there's a little good news at the end here. Is it possible that oil discovery is about to pick up again? And maybe this is just a little lag, we haven't been looking in the right places. Well, let's zoom in on that. Yes, 1999 and 2000 were very good years for discovery. Those were years in which a lot of oil was found in Central Asia, in Kazakhstan, the Kashagan field. But since 2000, the rate of discovery has resumed its decline, and 2003, as a matter of fact, was the worst year for discovery since the early 1920s. And what are we talking about? This is the level of discovery we're talking about for the early 1920s. Another way of thinking about oil extraction versus consumption or discovery versus extraction rates is this graph, which shows how in the 1960s we were discovering more oil every year than we extracted and burned. We were building up our savings account of oil in the 60s. And that gradually declined a couple of good years here in the mid-70s. This is the North Sea, by the way, and Alaska. And by about 1980, we reached the inflection point. Since 1980, we've been extracting more oil every year than we discover. And so now, as of 2004, we're extracting about 4 to 5 barrels of oil for every new one that we discover. What's that done for exploration? This is basically the same graph we just saw a moment ago, but superimposed on it is the number of wildcat wells. Now, wildcats are exploratory wells. When it became clear that the rate of discovery was declining, the industry responded by investing more in exploration. But then that curve starts to go down again. Why is that? Why would the industry be investing less in exploration now? I mean, look at that. For a while, they were investing drilling almost 12,000 wildcat wells a year, and now they're only drilling 2,500 a year. Why would that be? Well, a clue to that is the fact that last year, globally, the oil industry invested $8 billion in discovery. It's not a small amount. And they found $4 billion worth of oil. Exploration is, for the most part, a money-losing strategy these days. Now, that may change, as the price of oil skyrockets, but that doesn't mean that they're going to find larger quantities of oil. It just means that whatever oil they find is going to be worth more money. A third way to predict the peak, add up nation-by-nation peaks to arrive at the date for global peak. Yeah, I mentioned earlier that other countries have followed the U.S. example and gone past their their oil production peaks. I'm not going to take you through 44 different slides like this, but they exist, and if you're interested, you can go to the website of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, and also the Oil Depletion Analysis Center, ODAC, O-D-A-C. ASPO and ODAC have excellent databases on oil extraction rates and discovery rates and so on for every one of the oil-producing countries. But this is just an example. Here's the North Sea. Back in the 1970s, the discoveries in the North Sea were a miracle. Here we were in the middle of this Arab oil embargo, and wonderful oil was being discovered in these nice, friendly countries, Denmark, Norway, United Kingdom. So this was really good news. But discoveries in the North Sea quickly tapered off, and production from the North Sea has now peaked as of between 2000 and 2003. The UK was the first to peak in 2000, and Norway peaked last year. This year, Great Britain, which benefited tremendously from the economic miracle of North Sea oil, Great Britain was known as the sick man of Europe throughout the 50s and 60s because, they'd lost their empire, and after World War II, they were just continually in the economic doldrums, and then they found all this oil, and, it was great for them. But this year, Great Britain once again becomes a net oil importer. So this is very significant. There's only a small number of nations in the column of oil exporters. And almost every year, one of those countries jumps ship and goes over to the column of oil importers, from oil exporters to oil importers. And the column of oil exporters gets shorter all the time. So if you do the math on individual country peaks, there are about 44 significant oil-producing countries, and of them, about 24 or 25 of them are past their all-time individual production peaks. If you do the math, you end up with something like 2006, 2007, 2008 as the range of most likely global oil production peak. And this is the conclusion that Richard Duncan, Walter Youngquist have arrived at. Now, we're starting to zoom in from very, very general kinds of guesstimates. We're starting to zoom in on some real hard data that allow us to visualize or predict the peak much more exactly, probably to within 2 or 3 or 4 years. So this fourth method is combining new production capacity needed in the next few years with the production capacity now in development. Now, this would only work in a situation where you're already sure that global oil production peak is likely to occur within a few years. Once you know that, then it's time to start looking at what are the actual needs for new production capacity and where is that going to come from? When is supply no longer going to meet demand? Okay. This slide is from the International Energy Agency. Again, there's nothing in this information that's at all controversial. And this slide is showing that in 2005, we will need to add more production capacity just to stay even. How much? Well, we're going to be talking in terms of millions of barrels per day. Right now, the world uses about 82 million barrels per day of oil. And that's a total of conventional oil and non-conventional petroleum. And I'll talk about the distinction between those two in a while. 82 million barrels total. So we have to have production capacity at least equal to that in order to meet the 82 million barrels a day that we need. And we like to have spare production capacity on top of that in case there's, hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico or civil war in Venezuela or who knows what. We need some spare production capacity on top. Okay, so in 2005, we're going to need another 1.5 million barrels per day of new production capacity to meet demand growth. Now, that's conservatively estimated. Actually, in 2004, the rate of demand growth was higher than this. And why? Mostly because of China, and secondarily India and the U.S. The Chinese are, buying cars. We all have these nice images in our minds of millions of Chinese riding bicycles through the city streets. Last year, Shanghai banned bicycles from the city streets because the bicycles were getting in the way of the cars. General Motors, VW, all of the big car companies are opening factories in China. So next year, we will need another 1.5 million barrels a day of production capacity to deal minimally with increased demand. Then on top of that, we need another almost 4 million barrels a day of new production capacity to make up for depletion of the existing resource. There are so many fields that are already past their all-time production peaks. Fields in East Texas, fields in Indonesia, in Iran, all over the place. So in order to make up for depletion from existing oil wells that are past their peaks and on their way down, we need to find and develop another 3 million barrels a day of new production capacity. So a total of about 5.5, almost 6 million barrels a day. So that's a big, big job for the industry to develop another 5.5 million barrels a day of new production capacity. But then we have to do the same thing in 2006. We have to do the same thing in 2007. This is cumulative. So that by the end of the decade, we will have had to develop something like 35 million barrels a day of new production capacity. And remember, we're using a total of about 82 million barrels a day, so that's a significant fraction. So where is all that new production capacity going to come from? That's a big question. The oil industry itself is wondering about it. This is John Thompson of ExxonMobil. He's saying, to meet projected demand in 2015, the industry will have to add about 100 million oil equivalent barrels a day of new production. Of course, he's talking about oil and natural gas. That's equal to about 80% of today's production level. In other words, by 2015, we will need to find, develop, and produce a volume of new oil and gas that's equal to 8 out of every 10. He's sounding the alarm here. Because, you know, you saw the graphs about discovery. There's very little new oil being discovered. Where's the new production capacity going to come from? It's got to come either from new discoveries of conventional oil, development of unconventional resources, which are extremely expensive and difficult to develop, talking about Canadian tar sands now, which is environmentally ruinous. And I don't want to talk about the tar sands that much, but you know, you just can't arbitrarily ramp up rates of production from someplace like the Alberta tar sands. The physical, logistical problems with increasing production at a site like that are immense. Currently, Canada's getting about 1 million barrels a day worth of oil from the tar sands. And there are plans on growing that to 2 million, maybe up to 4 million barrels a day over the next 20 years. So that's a significant resource for Canada. The amount of hydrocarbon molecules in the ground there is tremendous. You know, if you just thought of that in terms of regular conventional oil, it's almost equal to the rest of the world put together. It's a huge amount of hydrocarbon molecules, but it's in a form that you simply can't get out of the ground at the rate that we would like. So development of unconventional resources will add, yes, but it's not going to do what we need. And then there's reserve growth, which is it's a little more technical discussion. Reserve growth was a big factor in U.S. oil fields for a number of reasons, some of them having to do simply with taxation. The oil companies in the U.S. tended to underbook their reserves, so they didn't have to pay taxes on them. And then every year they would book reserve increases officially in order to keep their stock values up. And there are many official agencies like the USGS and the International Energy Agency have assumed that the rest of the world will have the same kind of reserve growth as resulting from underestimates of existing reserves. But that's extremely unlikely to happen because in the rest of the world, it's a different situation. You don't have the same motives for companies to underbook reserves. And new recovery technologies do, in fact, help, but they tend not to push back the date of peak. All they do is they make the decline curve a little more gentle. So where is the new production capacity going to come from? Nobody knows, quite frankly. This is a very helpful picture from the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. This shows regular oil, which has been more or less at a plateau for many years. And most of the growth, as you can see, is in unconventional sources, heavy oil, deep water, polar, plant natural gas liquids, tar sands, and so on. Again, which is much more expensive to find and produce, and it's going to make up an increasing share of oil going forward because the conventional stuff is what's declining first. Another slide from the International Energy Agency. Again, OPEC, actually the world as a whole, oil industry likes to keep lots of spare production capacity, maybe 4 to 10 million barrels a day in reserve in case it's needed. But look what's happened in 2004. Spare production capacity has fallen off the table. There's virtually none in the system currently. Again, another IEA slide. And I like to use these IEA slides because the International Energy Agency, headquartered in Paris, is the world authority on petroleum. They are very conservative in their statistics. And even they are talking about a coming oil shock. They're talking about older fields being more mature and declining. New discoveries are of smaller fields. This industry is being forced to produce flat out. And global reserves have been overstated for political reasons. Now, this is an extraordinary admission because the optimistic economists and officials have been relying on reserve growth from underestimates of existing reserves to make up the difference. The assumption is that existing reserves have been underestimated and therefore, you know, we have nothing to worry about. But the IEA is telling us exactly the opposite. Now, what's this all about? It turns out that in the 1980s, 86 and 87, OPEC made a rule change which said that oil could be extracted and exported by member nations commensurate with the amount of reserves. So this created a motivation for OPEC member nations to over-report the reserves so that they could export more and gain more export revenues as a result. So in 1986, 1987, and 1988, OPEC countries reported reserve increases of between 50 and 200%. And there were no significant new discoveries taking place during that time in those countries. So, how much oil is in Saudi Arabia? Is it 256 billion barrels, as we're constantly told in the newspapers and Time magazine and so on? Probably not. It's probably considerably less than that. The same with Oman and Kuwait and all of the countries of OPEC. And the IEA is essentially admitting the same thing. There's a shift to more expensive, risky, non-conventional areas, and the industry has to run harder just to tread water and offset depletion. Meanwhile, our government is still telling us these nice, optimistic stories about how we won't have to worry about global oil peak for another 20 or 25 years. How do they do that? Well, the USGS, which issued an important study in 1999, used an interesting statistical method. They said, let's take an area that hasn't been explored very well, like East Greenland. We can be 95% sure that one barrel of oil will be found in East Greenland. It's almost a sure thing. But we can only be 5% sure that a significant amount, like say 112 billion barrels, will be found in East Greenland, actually off the shore in the deep water. So let's split the difference and assume that we'll find 47 billion barrels there. Applying that statistical method globally, you arrive at the assumption that global oil discovery is about to make a U-turn and start upward again. Experience is not bearing that out. That assumption does not appear to be based in reality. So these nice optimistic projections that we're getting from the U.S. Department of Energy and the U.S. Geological Survey are not based in reality. As a matter of fact, just 2 weeks ago, the recently retired vice president for exploration of Saudi Aramco, a man named Sadad Al-Husseini, gave a radio interview to British radio Channel 4. in which he's made some startling statements. And remember who this is: retired vice president of exploration for Saudi Aramco, one of the most knowledgeable people in the world about oil. And he's asked about Saudi reserves, and he says, Saudi reserves have been dramatically overstated. That alone should be, you know, banner headline in the New York Times. Then he says, when people in the industry hear American official projections for future consumption of oil, they laugh because they know that that oil just isn't there. Finally, the interviewer asks him, well, should we be worried? And he says, yes, we should be very worried. Hence, the crude oil spot price, which we all know has been rising dramatically just in recent weeks. Does that mean it's going to continue? Who knows? I don't try to predict prices, because there are two things going on with prices. There's supply, and I can be fairly confident that supply will be restricted in the fairly near future, over the next 2, 3, 4 years. But there's also the matter of demand. And demand can respond to all kinds of irrational cues, like, for example, economic depression kills demand. If there's less economic activity occurring in a country, its demand for energy resources goes down. And that can cause the price of energy resources to go down, even if there's less in the way of fuel to go around. So prices are hard to predict. But let's look at where the remaining oil resources are. No secrets here. Europe, Asia Pacific, North America, former Soviet Union, Africa, South and Central America, and the Middle East. Now, is it any wonder why this little area of the world is of some interest to lots of folks? Now, as we saw, these reserves have been overstated. So we should probably whack about a third of this bar off in our minds. But even if we do so, this is still a lot of oil compared to what exists in the rest of the world. And it's congregated in a pretty small place, this little horseshoe-shaped region of eastern Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Oman, western Iran, and parts of Iraq. That's where most of it is. It's not very big. But it's going to become increasingly important from a geopolitical point of view. It already is extraordinarily important. But look at this. Non-OPEC oil is peaking first. Right? We're talking about oil from places like South America and North Sea and the United States primarily, and former Soviet Union. OPEC oil, on the other hand, is going to see a much more gradual decline. And so past right about now, 2005 or so, the majority of the oil being produced is going to be from OPEC. So that little region of the world that we just saw is going to have increasing geopolitical importance. It's important now, but in the years ahead, it's going to become a lot more important. And we have a plan for dealing with it, don't we? I like to call this slide the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. The original invasion of Iraq, you may recall, was called Operation Iraqi Liberation. But that name was changed within only a few days. I never understood why. Our officials do understand the basic outlines of the problem. Dick Cheney, of course, is a retired executive of Halliburton, the world's largest oil services company. And while he was acting in that capacity in 1999, he gave a speech to the International Petroleum Institute in London, in which he said, there's no point in reading this, because he's basically saying what we've already seen. There will be an average of 2% annual growth in demand, along with 3% natural decline in production from existing reserves. That means by 2010, we'll need on the order of another 50 million barrels a day. Where's it going to come from? So when resources get scarce, people have a tendency to fight over them. That doesn't mean that's the only thing we can do. That's not the only response that we can have, but historically, that's been a very common response of people. So seeing that oil is about to become more scarce and expensive, and seeing that our entire way of life has come to be based on it, one could fairly reliably, I think, predict the likelihood of resource wars over oil. And they're likely to occur between rich consuming nations and poorer producing nations that might want to withhold the resource in order to profit here from it. I mean, what's happening right now, you know, with oil at $50 a barrel? Is oil actually that much more expensive to produce right now than it was 2 years ago? No, not that much. It gets a little more expensive to produce all the time because more of it's coming from deep water and so on, but not that much more expensive to produce. And yet it's twice as expensive. So where's all that extra money going? Who's getting it? Well, it's, of course, going to the oil companies, which are making record profits, and also the oil-producing nations, which are making more in revenue. So we're seeing the transfer of wealth on an increasing scale from oil consumers to oil producers. And as the price continues to go up, that transfer of wealth will accelerate. Would you think that might be a motive for some kind of conflict? And I'm not. Conflict can take many forms. Conflict between consuming nations, such as the U.S. and China, which is now the second foremost oil importing nation. And China is increasing its rate of imports at something like 30 to 40% a year right now. China is competing directly head-to-head with the U.S. for oil contracts going forward in places like Saudi Arabia, West Africa, and Venezuela. Recently, Saudi Arabia let some long-term contracts for oil, and all of those contracts went to China, zero to the U.S. We're likely also to see increasing civil wars within producing nations for control of their own resources. Already we see that in places like Colombia and South America, in Nigeria, likely in Iraq in the future, and asymmetrical warfare between rich consuming nations and non-state entities in producing nations, otherwise known as terrorism. Okay, this slide simply shows the increasing dependency from less stable areas. See, the U.S. likes to get as much of its oil as it can from South America, Canada, West Africa, North Sea, and it likes to get as little as it can manage from the Middle East. Most of that Middle Eastern oil is going to Japan and some to Europe. Europe's getting much of its oil from the North Sea. It's interesting, Europe's getting less of it. More North Sea oil is going to the U.S. than is going to Europe, whereas Europe is getting a lot of oil from Russia, former Soviet Union. Okay, where are the coming oil wars likely to break out? Of course, the Middle East, West Africa, South America, Central Asia. Okay, if we don't want to see that happen, what are our alternatives? Clearly, we would need, in this country, to start looking at energy alternatives. And when we look at the situation there, I have to say, it's a bit bleak. I, of course, as you can imagine, am a passionate advocate of renewable energy alternatives. I have solar panels on my house, and I drive a biodiesel-fueled old Mercedes and so on, but you know, you have to look at the total picture, at the actual numbers. We are overwhelmingly dependent right now on fossil fuels. This is nuclear, wood and waste, hydroelectric power, geothermal, and other. And if you look at the footnote, the other includes solar and wind. So let's explode that a little bit, look at it as a pie chart. If you look at the total pie chart of U.S. energy consumption, petroleum, natural gas, coal, nuclear. Okay, this is the renewable section of the pie, and it makes up about 6 to 7%. So of that 6 or 7% slice, most is conventional hydroelectric power. We can't grow that very much. We've already dammed most of the rivers. Wood, yeah, we still use wood to heat our houses, but we're not going to grow that tremendously, or, you know, we'll cut all the forests down. Burning waste in municipal plants to generate electricity, yeah, that's a good idea, but having waste depends on primary productivity. You can't just arbitrarily increase the amount of waste available. geothermal, alcohol fuel, and then 1% wind and 1% solar. Now, that 1% isn't 1% of our total energy budget. The 1% is, that's 1% of this little slice. Okay. So that, in fact, if we were to take the total amount that we're currently getting from wind and solar, the production capacity we've built up over the past 20 years, and take that amount and double it, and then double that, we still wouldn't even be up to 1% of our national energy budget. So we're starting virtually from square one. We have the technology, perhaps, but in terms of the implementation of that technology, we're many years, decades behind, and hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars of investment are going to be required in order to make that transition. I'm not a huge advocate of hydrogen. I'm sure that it will have many important niche applications in our energy future, but I'm not a believer in the idea of a hydrogen economy for a number of reasons, and this could be a fairly long discussion, but I can recommend some sources on this. So we're not going to be able to make an easy transition using a supply-side strategy. In other words, simply by substituting other sources for petroleum. It's way too late for that. If we'd started down that road in the 70s and kept it up, we might imagine ourselves doing that. But at this late stage in the game, a supply-side substitution strategy is not going to get us there. So we have to look at the demand side of the equation. We have to find some way of reducing our need for energy. So where do we start? Well, we have to look at where we're actually using energy in our daily lives. Changing our light bulbs over to compact fluorescence, that's a good idea, but look at how much energy is actually going to home lighting versus some of these other things. This is heating a 1,000 square foot house over a year. Okay, that uses a lot of energy. If we can save energy there, if we can cut our usage there by 25%, that has a lot more impact than changing our light bulbs. Or driving 10,000 miles in an average European car. Okay, this slide is from France, by the way, so it's a little more optimistic than a similar slide would be using U.S. statistics. So saving 25% here has a tremendous impact than 1 year of shopping at the supermarket. Another big use of energy is food production. We're going to have to do the same thing the Cubans did and go to organic agriculture and local production for local consumption. Let's go back to transportation, because that's where we're most vulnerable. That's where we use 97% of the oil. We use it for transportation. And transportation is not just, you know, going to visit grandma once a year. Transportation is how do you get to the store, and how does the stuff get to the store for you to go there and buy? You know, the average food item on an American plate has traveled 12 to 1,500 miles to get there, fossil fuel miles. Transportation is survival at this point for us. That's the basis of the global economy. Okay, so we have to find ways of reducing the energy intensity of transportation. No, yes, we have to do that, but we also have to reduce the amount of transportation that's occurring. Again, this is a French slide. It's, you know, just a comparison of the energy efficiency of different forms of transportation. Short-haul plane, average car, long-haul plane, regional train, long-distance bus, city bus, commercial train, national train, Paris Metro, TGV, high-speed train, walking. Hey, that's pretty good. And finally, the bicycle, which is the most efficient form of transportation known. So here we are. We've invested everything in this country, again, French slide, okay, people in Paris can decide to take the Paris metro and use a third the amount of energy as somebody driving a car, right? Well, I live in Santa Rosa, California. Can I take the Santa Rosa metro? It doesn't exist, sorry. We have destroyed most of our public transportation infrastructure in this country. Ridership on public transportation in the U.S. peaked in the 1940s and has been declining ever since. Why? Because people are just so stupid? No, because decisions have been made at the top planning levels to invest our money in highways rather than trains, trolleys, streetcars, and so on. And those are decisions that our descendants will curse us for. Well, somehow we have to do the best we can here. If we're going to use cars, we have to use them as efficiently as we can. Remember the Cuban movie where everybody was piling into the cars? You know, that's what they use traffic cops in Cuba for these days. If a traffic cop sees a car with too few passengers, they stop the car and make it wait until they have more passengers. I mean, when you see one of these huge urban assault vehicles, a Hummer or something, driving down the street with a driver, no passengers, it's extraordinary. No more. We are going to need a World War II level of effort to deal with this problem. And in World War II, we realized we were up against a common enemy, that our way of life hung in the balance, and people were willing to make changes in how they lived. You couldn't just walk into any department store and buy nylon stockings. You couldn't buy new tires for your car or gasoline for your car anytime you wanted. These things were rationed. But people were willing to go along with it because they knew what was at stake. People were growing victory gardens, and I recently read a history of the victory garden movement, which is fascinating. It started at the grassroots level. It didn't start with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In fact, the USDA tried to suppress the victory garden movement. And when it became clear that they couldn't suppress it, they took credit for it. You know, we humans are incredibly cooperative if given half a chance. We have the challenge in this country that we have developed a national mythology of independence and of entitlement. And we have a $225 billion a year industry that supports those illusions called the U.S. advertising industry. It's the most effective propaganda system ever devised by human beings. And it has one message: buy, use, consume. You will not be a fulfilled person unless you do so in ever-increasing degrees. This is a tragedy, and it's something that somehow needs to change. We need exactly the opposite message. What are we going to do? Well, we can fight for the last drop. And given this most recent, quote, election, unquote, I'm sorry to say that we are being propelled along that path, whether we like it or not. I wish it were otherwise. But I don't see any change in that coming in the next little while. We can wait for a techno fix. We can assume that there must be smart people somewhere coming up with answers to our problem and just, you know, wait for them to come up with it. Don't worry, technology will save you. No, I suggest that sooner or later we are going to have to address the underlying ecological dilemma. See, I'm a teacher of human ecology. That's what I teach. And this is how I understand this problem. When I talk to rooms full of economists or engineers, they all want to go for the techno fix. You know, the problem is we're running out of oil, therefore the solution is finding a substitute. No, that's a basic misunderstanding of what's going on here. What we're facing is a particularly nasty instance of what every species and every human society comes up against sooner or later, and that's what I call the universal ecological dilemma: resource depletion, habitat destruction, and population pressure. There's nothing in our particular situation that's unique in that regard, except that we have hooked ourselves on a particularly powerful resource called petroleum, which is rapidly running out. There are only a few possible responses to the ecological dilemma. You can move elsewhere, you can exploit the existing resources more intensively, and that's what we've been doing for thousands of years using, you know, we started in Africa and we've moved everywhere that human beings can possibly live. We've, invented plows and steam shovels and stock exchanges and everything else you can imagine to exploit existing resources more intensively. Find new resources. Well, how about uranium? How about methane hydrates in the ocean floor? How about, it's kind of running out of these. Sooner or later, we're going to have to do what most species end up doing when they face the universal ecological dilemma, and that is go to demand-side responses. See, these are supply-side responses, and we as a species have become extraordinarily ingenious at finding new supply-side strategies at dealing with the ecological dilemma. The problem with supply-side strategies is that they're always temporary fixes, and they tend to they tend to yield diminishing returns over time, whether it's irrigation agriculture or fossil fuel industrial civilization. There tend to be diminishing returns from over time from supply side strategies. Sooner or later, we are going to have to embrace the demand side strategies. Limiting population, by that I don't mean killing off a bunch of people, I mean finding the most humane ways possible to reduce reproduction rates around the world, including in the countries, in wealthy countries. Limit per capita resource use, especially in wealthy countries. And if we can't do any of that, nature will take care of it for us. Nature always has ways. And ultimately, you know, our vice president tells us that the American way of life is non-negotiable. Well, beyond a certain point, nature does not negotiate. Right? So if all else fails, there's always famine and disease to take care of it. I would prefer us to find coordinated and cooperative ways of dealing proactively and primarily using demand-side strategies with this ecological dilemma that we found ourselves in. If we're going to do that, we're going to have to embrace global, international agreements to limit oil production, oil exports, and oil imports. There's simply no other way around it. And that's going to be a tough thing to do because oil exporters will have an incentive not to buy in, and oil importers will have an incentive not to buy in. But if we don't, we'll be embroiled in global resource wars for the remainder of our lives, which is exactly, of course, what we've been told to expect. I don't think that there's a magic elixir, a magic solution to any of this. Nevertheless, the strategies that we have to develop are pretty clear, pretty obvious to anybody who thinks about them for more than a few minutes. Aim for maximum efficiency in what we do use. Localize and decentralize. Take this movie of globalization we've been living in for the past 20 years and run it in reverse. We need to become self-sufficient in our local communities, economically, in terms of food, energy, water. We need to use alternatives now rather than waiting for the market to tell us, oh, now solar is so inexpensive that we can substitute it for oil. Yeah, if we wait that long, we simply won't have the investment capital available. We have to use the alternatives now, even when fossil fuels may be cheaper. And we have to simply use less. And it's important also to raise awareness and talk about this issue, because the more people understand it, the more they will be willing to voluntarily make changes and demand that their leaders make changes. If we're completely blindsided by this, then what will happen is that our leaders, rather than wanting to tell us bad news, that our way of life is going to change, what they'll do is simply say, oh, it's the fault of those other people on the other side of the world. All we have to do is go bomb them for a while and everything will be fine. As I see it, our priorities must be something like this: ensuring local food security, identify your local food producers and make friends with them and help them out. Strategies like CSAs, community supported agriculture, farmers markets are extremely helpful, and also producing more food yourself. If you have a front yard or a backyard that you're not using, get your hands dirty. Take a course in permaculture or in biointensive gardening. Ensure local water security. This is serious business for many communities around the country. Think of the situation that Los Angeles is in right now, where it depends for its water source on places hundreds of miles away, or Las Vegas or Phoenix. These are not good places to put millions of people. And we've made some mistakes, and we're going to have to undo those. I'm not sure exactly how. Support your local economy by fostering local manufacturing of essential goods. Where were your shoes made? Do you know anybody who makes shoes? I can think of a few good occupations to go into right now, actually. And plan for long-term emergency services. Right now, we plan for short-term emergency services, and most of our emergencies are such that, you know, we can be bailed out in fairly short order by people other places. If there's a hurricane in Florida, well, very quickly, people in, you know, Seattle or St. Louis are sending their resources to Florida to help people there out. Well, if we're looking at a general and long-term emergency, we can't look to people outside our own community to bail us out. We're going to have to look for ways, and I don't have any, you know, I don't have this all figured out. I just know that this is what we need to do. It's going to take our creativity to come up with these kinds of strategies. And the sooner we start with it, the better. There are people starting to think along these lines in many communities around the country. And there are some organizations that are beginning to come up with material that can be helpful along these lines. I'm thinking particularly of the Post Carbon Institute, www.postcarbon.org, which is starting post-carbon outposts in communities around the country and around the world. And Post Carbon Institute is looking to supply materials for people in local communities to begin strategizing on how they can deal with these priorities. So I know this has not been a cheery presentation. It never is. But you know, I'm kind of quirky. I don't know if you're like me. I like to know, even if it's not pleasant news. I'd rather know than live in denial or live in illusion. And as far as I can tell, what I've told you is not slanted to be more pessimistic than the actual information warrants. I've tried to give it to you as accurately as I can so that you know where we're going and what we're up against. I hope it's been helpful to you. Thank you very much. Okay. Now, I'd be happy to entertain questions or comments.
I just have a quick question. Do you have an idea of how much we subsidize oil and what the actual price at the pump would be if we didn't have those subsidies?
Yeah, I saw a study on that just the other day. It ends up, the real price of oil, oh, I know who did it. It was the Center for Technology Assessment, Andrew Kimbrell's organization. And I think they just did it last year. And according to the CTI, or CTA, Center for Technology Assessment, real price for oil is somewhere between $10 and $15 a gallon, or real price of gasoline would be between $10 and $15 a gallon if we factored in the externalities.
In the U.S.
In the U.S., yeah.
Hello, Richard. Good to see you. Jan Lundberg.
Thank you.
I wanted to say that just kind of on the doom and gloom side of things first, the chart of OPEC production declining in sort of some sort of a slow arc downward. I think that's very unrealistic for the way the oil market works. And I think when the gap between supply and demand hits, we're going to have such a complete shortage and be virtually out that a lot of the scenarios for any kind of a tapering down of supplies is going to be unrealistic. I mean, when the doo-doo hits the fan, the global economy will implode. So your comments on the future changes are totally appropriate. And I don't think it is all about doom and gloom. I think we've got a tremendous opportunity with a change of culture ahead by necessity to deal with the energy situation, and we'll have to, you know, honor the earth and each other in a whole new way, and that'll be just tremendous. So thank you again for giving this presentation. Keep it up.
Thank you, Jan. Does everybody know who Jan Lundberg is?
Yeah.
He's published Culture Change, which is online. It's not in print, is it?
Not anymore.
Not anymore, yeah. But he's written extensively, and he and his family have an extensive background in oil. So he knows whereof he speaks. Thanks, Jan.
Yes, thank you. Great presentation. Could you possibly give us a couple of bullet points in terms of dealing with the techno-fix discussion about all of the coal available in North America?
Right, the coal available in North America, good question. Well, there's a heck of a lot of coal in North America. If all of it could be easily accessed, we would have hundreds and hundreds of years of coal. The problem, of course, is that it's not all easily accessed. And there's an engineer named Gregson Vo, who I've been in touch with by email, who works for a company under contract from the U.S. Department of Energy. And he was given the task of developing a Hubbert curve analysis of U.S. coal production, which he was delighted with because he's very much aware of the energy depletion issues, resource depletion issues. So he did his U.S. Hubbert curve analysis for coal and came up with a likely peak in 20 years. And that's as a result of the increasing inaccessibility of the remaining resources. And also he assumed increasing rates of demand for coal as petroleum becomes more scarce. So, yes, there's a lot of coal there, and we'll be burning a lot of it, no doubt. Like it, whether I personally or you like it or not, I'm sure we will. But it's not going to provide us with hundreds of years of current American lifestyle. Yes.
You were talking earlier about the telling us about how to help the cities, and we had a panel discussion with the mayor and some leaders. And I was just wondering, if you were a mayor, what kind of broad sweep changes would you try to establish? So just to give us some ideas.
Yeah, if I were mayor, the first thing I would do would be to bring together a planning commission to take into account the needs of the community and the scope of the challenge that would be facing us, and start coming up with some strategies. I would want to involve people at every level. If it were something that was just being imposed from the top down, I don't think it would work very well. I think what would have to be done is the person in leadership using information and persuasion to encourage the community as a whole to take up the issue. And that might be politically challenging, but hey, that's what I do. I have a good friend named Bob Gregson, who is the director of the Solar Living Institute up in Hopland. I don't know if you know Real Goods and the Real Goods catalog. He just ran for city council in Hopland, and he lost, but he ran on a peak oil platform. And the reason he lost is he's new to the community. He just moved to Hopland less than a year ago, so it was a foregone conclusion he wasn't going to win. But he ran anyway, and he's going to run again. next time there's an open seat, because he sees it as a way of helping to educate the community. I think that's a great idea.
Hello. Thank you for all this great information.
I hear a voice. Where's it coming from?
Right here.
Oh, thank you.
Hello. My name's Wendy. I live in Carpinteria. And you briefly mentioned under TechnoFix, hydrates, gas hydrates. Mm-hmm. I've been looking into them for about the last month and a half on the internet. I've been doing it, you know, personal research on that. And according to my findings, there's enough natural gas compressed under the ocean to last 1,000 to 2,000 years, depending on whose estimates you're looking at. And it's the problem right now is it's difficult to extract. They haven't come up with the technology, but it's not impossible. So I'd like you to comment on that. 1,000 to 2,000 years, that's a lot of gas.
That's a lot of gas. You're right to emphasize the technical problem. The Japanese have been doing a lot of research with methane hydrates, and they claim to have come up with a method. It's unclear yet whether it will be scalable. There's also methane hydrates trapped in tundra in northern Canada and Alaska and Siberia. Methane hydrates, I sure hope we don't go there for a number of reasons. First of all, of course, there's, you know, if we just continue, if we do find a techno fix in the form of methane hydrates, we'll just be putting more carbon into the atmosphere and causing more global warming and so on. but also, if something goes awry, methane is 20 times as powerful a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide is. And there's great concern that even if we don't try to harvest the methane hydrates, as the oceans warm, this could release the methane hydrates anyway, and they could come bubbling up and cause a runaway self-reinforcing greenhouse effect that would basically cook the Earth. This is without our meddling. Now, if we try to extract the methane hydrates, you know, I shudder to think. I just hope that we don't go there. That's all I can say.
Whenever I approach my friends and talk to them about peak oil, they always glaze over and they say, free market will take care of it, or there'll be some other form of technology which will come up and save us. And just like the point about methane hydrates.
Yeah.
And I was encouraged to read somewhere, I think it was in the book, Postcard, in your Power Down book, that you were trying to form a committee in Post Carbon Institute to address any emerging technological so-called magic elixirs. Is that true?
Well, that effort hasn't gotten very far because all of us in Post Carbon are a little overtaxed in terms of our abilities right now. There is another gentleman named Dick Lawrence who lives in Massachusetts who is an energy expert, an engineer, who is mounting this effort by way gathering together a number of other energy experts by way of the internet to tackle this problem, energy modeling. So we'll see what comes out of that. It's still in the very early stages, and I think it's going to take them probably at least 18 months to 2 years to come up with anything.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have, but I'd like to thank Richard Heinberg very much for a wonderful presentation.
Thank you all very much.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and as CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD, or you can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the digit 4, all.net. If you valued what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized, democratic civic media. Thanks very much for listening.